Hi everyone, welcome to Beyond the Benchmark, the EFG podcast. My name is Mo Zafzal. I'm the Global Chief Investment Officer for EFG. And today we are going to do a deep dive into a by popular demand topic, GLP-1s. So to help me navigate this sort of technical topic, I have Mike Clulo and Chelsea Wyatta from our Portland and San Francisco offices respectively. Guys, welcome.
Thanks, yeah. Miles, for having us on.
And both Mike and Chelsea are senior portfolio managers at EFG. So let's start, Mike, with GLP-1s. What are they and how do they work?
Thanks, Miles, for having me on. So let's just start. What is GLP? I guess GLP is something we should all be familiar with. You know, if we sat down to eat our breakfast, lunch, or dinner today, we all had GLP released in the gut. GLP is a hormone with three major functions. So the first function is it's a communication tool with the pancreas. It tells the pancreas, release insulin so that we can digest all of the glucose, all of this energy that comes into your body and deliver it to various parts, you know, your arms, your brain, your head, your heart, et cetera, et cetera. The second function of GLPs is it actually slows down the gastric emptying process. That's just a fancy way of saying it slows down the process of food moving from your stomach into your small and large intestines. And the last thing that GLPs do in their natural state is it actually communicates with your brain. It communicates with the hypothalamus, and it tells you whether or not you feel sated or satiety, you know, that satisfied, that full feeling that you get when you've eaten a big meal. So it's kind of a three-pronged mechanism. And the GLPs that we're talking about today happen to be GLP-1 agonists. These are the drugs. These are artificial. They're generated in the laboratory. Think of them as peptides. Think of them as mini proteins. Think of them as artificial hormones. So let's say you have GLPs in your body, and what we're trying to do is actually increase the amount of GLP in your system to increase the insulin production, reduce blood sugar levels. That's one mechanism. Make you feel full longer for a longer period of time, and then increase that satiety, that satisfied feeling throughout the day. If used properly, some of the new best-in-class drugs out of Eli Lilly or Novo Nordisk, you can expect to lose 15 to 20% of your weight over a 1 year period.
So obviously they're quite difficult drugs to administer. Do you want to just tell us a little bit how they administer today and maybe how they'll be administered in the future?
Yeah. So the technology has come a long way. When we first started looking at this sector, there was a small biotech company called Amylin Pharmaceuticals. It was acquired by Eli Lilly. We owned it in the early 2000s. They have a twice daily injectable drug called Byetta, and it was a GLP drug. They first developed it for type 2 diabetes, but also found that it actually triggered weight loss. And so by extending out the activity, the long-acting nature of the drug, you're now able to administer this through a small injection. It's a once weekly injection, or orally. The oral formulations tend to be a little bit less effective. Semaglutide is the generic name for Novo's drug. If you take the drug for diabetes, it's called Ozempic. If you take the drug for weight loss, it's called Wegovy. Eli Lilly's drug is very similar in nature. That's the generic name for that drug is tirzepatide. And if you take it for diabetes, it's called Mounjaro. If you take it for weight loss, it's Zepbound. But again, it's the same active ingredient.
So obviously, Mike, you've been around for a while and you've seen lots of fads sort of come in over the years. From your kind of perspective, is this fad or is it real? And, what does history tell us?
Is it a fad or is it real? I think that the short answer is yes. It's a little bit like AI. Everyone is talking about it.
But perhaps, and it's a very powerful tool, but it's not used properly in its current form, but we will get there eventually. So right now, patients on average are taking these drugs for a 6 to 9 month period. They are losing 30 pounds, let's say. Going off the drug, the hunger returns, and they're gaining half of their weight back in a very short period of time. So if you go on the drug for a short period of time, you put the weight back on, you're not necessarily going to get the lasting benefits unless you can actually stay on that drug for, you know, a maintenance administration. So they've done a number of studies to show that if you lose the weight and you're on these drugs for an extended period of time and you're compliant, there's a fairly significant reduction in cardiovascular events, sleep apnea, Alzheimer's, dementia, arthritis. I mean, just think of all the types of disorders that are triggered by excess weight and where we are in the United States and elsewhere in terms of the percentage of the population that is overweight or obese is quite high right now.
So I think the key thing here, I guess, is why there's been so much reaction to it is obviously everybody does want to get a bit lighter. That's absolutely the case. But I guess also the impact it has on long-term impacts are pretty huge. For example, and just thinking out loud here, if everyone's on these drugs or some form of those drugs, the need for healthcare later on in life will obviously going to be a lot better. How have the sort of drug companies, the other drug companies that produce the more traditional, you know, healthcare benefits performing?
Well, in terms of relative, so the big concern is that if these drugs are widely available to the broader population, it would theoretically reduce the incidence of colorectal cancer. It would reduce the incidence of stroke, cardiovascular disease. And so the initial impact was a fairly sharp reduction in the stock prices of many of these medical device or biotech or biopharmaceutical companies that had exposure to these large end markets. I think what we found is that there is a lot of hype. There's a lot of fear that goes out there initially, but we've seen this play out in the past. In terms of history, just for perspective, gastric bypass surgery hit the mass market when I was working in the early 2000s. It's a great approach for weight loss. It has the same exact outcomes or benefits as GLP-1s, a little bit more of an invasive process. But yet, unsurprisingly, it has had no impact on diabetes, obesity. I'm not sure what that says about society, but on average, we have in the United States roughly 300,000 bypass surgeries done on a yearly basis, and yet we've had a consistent uptick in the incidence of diabetes, in the incidence of obesity.
So even though this has had so great benefits, it's not necessarily, you know, going to give the outcome that everyone's kind of hoping, or certainly there's question marks as to whether that outcome's going to come through, given that we've had similar things in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to costs, because you have this push and pull. You have the big pharmaceutical companies running clinical studies to say, look, if you take GLP-1s over an extended period of time, we can reduce the incidence of stroke. Therefore, the drug is cost justified. If you can reduce the incidence of Alzheimer's, dementia, arthritis, just think of the long-term impact on the healthcare system. It's overwhelmingly positive. The HMOs, the reimbursement authorities, are pushing back and saying, hey, that's great. I understand what the long-term thesis is. I don't get that benefit because I have patients going on this for a very short period of time. They're putting the weight back on, and these long-term outcomes I'm not necessarily seeing. And if you think the average HMO has a patient for 2 to 3 years on average before they switch to another HMO, curing this patient, getting them on a long-term therapy, and reducing their long-term healthcare costs, I don't necessarily benefit from that. And so that's been the push and pull. Big Pharma is running clinical studies to say, look how great these wonder drugs are. And I do believe they are wonder drugs. If we can improve the efficacy, if we can reduce the side effects, and then we can make them more cost effective. The problem is the HMOs don't necessarily see that. So the buzz are people that can afford these therapies out of pocket, getting reimbursement at the current point in time for weight loss is near impossible at this point. And so it's our expectation that while these drugs are considered wonder drugs, if you're compliant and you adhere to the regimens, they're not ideal in their current form. And it would be nice also to see some of that cost element come back down.
Now, just on that, are you seeing pressure building up on the drug companies to start, discounting this already? Obviously, we've got the Inflation Reduction Act impacting 26. Do you think they'll be part of that or unlikely to be?
So at this point, unlikely to be. The Inflation Reduction Act takes effect in 2026, so it would impact the top 10 drugs. We are already seeing the big pharma industry in a frenzy to acquire additional products to offset the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act. On average, some of these blockbuster drugs are going to feel an impact of roughly 25% haircut onto their prices. And these are multi-billion-dollar franchises. So you can imagine the impact. I don't believe that the GLP-1s will make the radar screen at present, but they will over time, hit the radar screen. Just to give you some perspective, on average, in the United States, the cost to take these treatments without insurance is a little over $1,000 per month. If you think the average GDP per capita in the United States is a little over $60,000, that is not necessarily a therapy that most patients can take over an extended period of time. A lot of people are turning toward compound pharmacies. So these are people that are taking the active ingredient in Novo or Lilly's drug. So they're taking semaglutide, combining it with vitamin B12 and shipping that directly to patients. Taking that form of the drug costs about two thirds less on average. So about $300 per month. So you see a lot of people coming onto the drug and either dropping off because they can't afford it over an extended period of time or trying to switch to some of these generic versions. You also have, just from a competitive perspective, over I believe 50 companies working on their own formulations of a GLP-1. So I think it's an industry where the hype is real. I think the potential is real, but I think the competitive landscape, people are underestimating the potential impact of competition, and that will ultimately reduce prices over time.
Yeah, that was going to be my kind of next question, is around that competitive landscape. I guess you've just answered. So you've got, did you say 50 companies coming up with similar types of drugs? I guess it's going to be pretty competitive out there.
Yeah, absolutely. So every major pharmaceutical company is either internally developing or just recently acquired a small biotech in order to have that story for investors to say, hey, we are also working on GLP-1s. I think where the work needs to be done is how can we make these drugs not necessarily more effective, but lower cost and more easier to administer for patients. So, a good example is Amgen is working on a program to have a quarterly administration of a treatment. So, four times per year, you get an injection in the abdomen. And, that can have a nice long-lasting impact and enhance compliance. They're also working on a variety of formulations of oral or pill formulations to make it a little bit more easier to administer. So we'll see exactly how it shakes out. As I talked about before, GLP is not necessarily something unique. It's something that a variety of companies can manufacture on their own, tweak with their own delivery formulations, add a couple of other hormones. GIP is also in the mix. So Eli Lilly has a GLP-GIP drug. It's dual mechanism. And so you're going to see these combination therapies, you're going to see long acting therapies, you're going to see oral combinations. So all of that means lots of competition. The prices will come down over time, and we'll just see how it all plays out.
I was going to say certainly in our Google Trends analytics, AI and GLP-1s are the ones that are most searched items on Google Trends at this point in time. I guess there's no big surprises that would be the case. So turning over to Chelsea now. Obviously, we talked about the drugs. We talked about the companies, impacted. I think Mike sort of alluded to had a bit of an impact on medical device companies, although that seems to have passed a bit now. But the impact on consumer staples, i.e. food companies, and food we put in sort of wide brackets here because it could be restaurants, it could be, supermarkets to companies that actually produce the, baked beans and the bread that everyone eats. But the impact has been already quite stark.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's a difficult thing to quantify because staples have had sort of a trifecta of headwinds over the last, call it 12 to 18 months, where, you just spoke to two of them. The major trends last year in investing were AI and GLPs, and staples don't particularly play in AI, and the GLP were a direct headwind to them. And then, of course, the third was the impact of inflation and the need for these companies to raise prices in a very, to support their margins, which then led to lower volumes. And so if you think about those three concurrent headwinds, valuations for the group have been substantially compressed. When you look over a very long time horizon, staples is, as everybody knows, a very defensive industry. It tends to command a premium valuation that tends to land at, a mid to high single digits range above the broader market. And more recently, we're seeing them trade at a discount. And that's definitely because of the lack of the AI opportunity. That's because of the volume concern and whether or not there's an opportunity for these companies to gain back the volumes that they had, given their need to retain these higher prices that they've implemented over the past year. But it's also the concern from investors that these wonder drugs are going to start to take hold and that there will be a psyche shift for consumers in terms of what they're willing to eat if they take these drugs.
Now, we've had quite a few companies talk about this impact already. Everyone from kind of Walmart to the local sandwich shop down the road. But what are companies saying about GLP-1s in particular? I guess the other AI thing they're never going to be able to be involved in, and certainly inflation is on its way down. So hopefully that does come back. What are the companies in general saying about this impact?
I think broadly, management teams are being very careful about how they address it because they want to be able to say we're in really early stages, we don't have enough data to really link it yet, but they're also being conservative because they don't want to look like they are on the wrong side of this argument. And so they're being careful about saying, it's definitely starting to be there, but it's immaterial at this point. And I think that's where you can stay in that zone for a while. You can call it 6 months to a year, but there will have to be a point in time when these management teams, these CEOs, start to really talk about it in earnest and say, this is impacting our business and here's how we're responding to it. And I think we're at early enough stage in the industry to where they're not quite sure how they're addressing it yet and what the best way to address it yet. And that's why they're taking this sort of longer term tact with it to say, it is there, we're monitoring it, we're going to appropriately address it in time.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion out there. And to be honest, it's quite widespread. It's from the drinks companies, even the drinks companies in Europe are also kind of coughing up some of it. They're kind of saying, we can see there's an impact. We don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. Exactly how you say it's going to last and what impact, will it have?
Yeah, I would say that, the drug is hitting the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is your reward center. And so the effect of the drug is it makes you just more agnostic on food or which food you normally would consume. You could say, once you're on the drug, I'm hungry, I will take that salad. It looks just as good as this pastrami sandwich. And so I think that's a subtle effect, but also a subtle effect is it also impacts addiction. And so I could take or leave cigarettes, I could take or leave alcohol, I could take or leave gambling. And so that you're starting to see some of that effect sprinkle into the consumer sector as well.
Oh, that certainly is very interesting. So Chelsea, you and I shared this survey from a company called Numerator. Do you want to tell us a little bit about their findings and to kind of take this message on a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Really great job done by Numerator. They saw that this trend was coming online, and they were one of the first groups to go out there and create a study to directly interface with these users of this drug, regardless of whether they're using it for diabetes purposes or weight loss purposes. And they have the ability to slice and dice the data to be able to see how spending patterns have changed as these users are on the drug for longer periods of time. And that's where we get the best information, right? Is where it's not just somebody's on the drug for 6 weeks, they lose their 10 pounds, they go off it. It's the people that are using it for longer periods of time. So they were able to get together with about 100,000 people and dive into what are they spending more on, what are they spending less on. And very interestingly, they were able to show that consumers that were using GLP specifically for weight loss had about a 10% reduction in the amount of money they were spending at the grocery store. And they were able to highlight some of the categories where they were spending less. And it was exactly where you'd think it would be, because early on in your adoption of your weight loss journey, you're going to try to eat less of the, you know, really starchy foods, your candies, your snacks, your ice creams. And so all of these prepared bakery goods, these things have been very drastically reduced in these consumers' baskets. But what I thought was really interesting is on the flip side of that, these consumers are also going to the grocery store more frequently. So they have a higher rate of return visits to the grocery store because now they're relying on more fresh foods that have shorter shelf lives. And so it's a very interesting give and take, because while there are a handful of companies that are obviously going to be impacted because they are not able to reachieve those volumes that we spoke about earlier, there are other companies that might be beneficiaries of saying, hey, we are a healthier for you alternative that now these consumers are leaning towards. And consumer behavior in this area can be a pretty sticky journey. If you say, I used to always eat Ritz crackers, which are, everybody knows, one of the worst possible things you can eat. They are so buttery, delicious, but so buttery. You flip that to something that's just marginally better for you, even if this consumer doesn't stay on the drug forever and does gain back some of their weight, they still might go back to that healthier for you cracker that they found on this GLP journey that allows them to stay healthier for longer. And so I thought it was really interesting to see sort of that data start to show itself in the survey. The other thing that they did a great job of dissecting was sort of the demographics behind who is using GLP-1 specifically for weight loss. And they were able to show, you know, the majority of the users are in a little bit older of an age bracket. They're this Gen X consumer. They tend to be a little bit higher income, and they tend to be in suburban markets. And so I don't want to, you know, be too specific and talk about what that means in general, though. What they also found was that the consumers that are taking them are using grocery delivery and online grocery ordering services more as well. And so there are a couple of industries that are real big beneficiaries of this shift. Even if we only want to look at who's losing, there are also companies that stand to gain significantly from these demographics that are adopting the drug.
So from an industry perspective, the winners and losers, how would you sort of classify them? How do you think about them?
Yeah, I would certainly say that my concern near term is on the volumes for the snacking companies and the candy companies. You know, those shelf stable goods that you used to fill your pantry with. If you're not rebuying those things and you're really serious about keeping the weight loss off after you stop taking the drugs, maybe you just don't buy those things anymore and you're buying other things that are healthier for you. So those companies, I think, are the ones that stand to have the most risk in the face of this new trend. I was surprised that as I did my research, the beverage companies are actually a little more stable than you might think, because they, throughout the past, you know, call it 10, 20 years, have done a wonderful job diversifying their exposure, not just to sodas. Now they all have bubbly water, and they have sports drinks, they have energy drinks that consumers already consider really strong, healthier for you alternatives. And so those companies might just begin shifting their focus away from the sodas and more towards those healthier for you alternatives. So they're not necessarily losing, it's just that that consumer is shifting across the value spectrum. And then, you know, I was actually surprised in the study, Numerator was able to show that alcohol was not nearly as different between the different groups as you would have expected. You would think that, you know, Mike alluded to the fact that this is an addiction, like it helps with your addiction. That has not yet shown up in the study. So I'm very keen to see how the alcohol industry is impacted by this over the long term, because if it's not showing up yet in the weight loss group, it will be interesting to see if it's something that gets utilized more in rehab facilities, and if there are people that need to exit addiction in that way. You know, maybe it's not the weight loss group that will have the alcohol impact, but rather the power users, if you will.
Yeah, I guess the other aside, I guess, is maybe thinking about restaurant companies. So if you go off and mm-hmm. you know, ordering a meal, you'll have some alcohol with that meal. If you're less likely to go out for the meal, you're less likely to have the alcohol, right? I guess that's the overall volume.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's kind of what you expect, but that's not necessarily coming out from the data yet.
Definitely. And, you know, a lot of companies rely on that incremental purchasing behavior. If you're at a restaurant and you're sitting down to have, whether it's a salad or a burger, you typically are offered, do you want fries with that? And if the consumer is saying, hey, I'm not hungry enough to then have those fries, that incremental lift on that comp ticket, that's meaningful to restaurants to lose that behavior. So I don't have the data for that quite yet, but I am interested to see as the industry gets more mature, whether that will be as substantial as we can, you know, sort of forecast it being.
So let's go through the scenario. So some of these companies or these industries realize that GLP is going to be a bit of a threat. What do you think they can do to try and overcome that threat?
Yeah. You know, the consumer staples industry, they have, and this is obviously that this is, I'm specifically talking about, you know, the food packaging companies, they have had to react to many prior instances of diet fads, et cetera. So if you think back to, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, it was the Atkins diet. And then more recently, it's been the organic movement and the gluten-free movement, et cetera. There's always something that's happening in the background that these companies are having to adapt to. And I think one of their best moves has always been just repackaging where it makes sense. So a great example is, you know, like a Cheerios that has always been a low cholesterol offering. They just now put a big sticker right on the front of the box that says low cholesterol. And so the consumer that's walking through the grocery store that's watching their cholesterol is like, oh, I can have Cheerios. And they could always have Cheerios. They just didn't know that before necessarily. But Cheerios is doing their best to show that that's the case. So I think that the repackaging is a low-hanging fruit opportunity. The other item is one that President Biden is actually apparently going to address in his State of the Union coming up. Shrinkflation, which is something that has come out of the inflation topic we were talking about earlier on in the podcast. As these companies have had to face, you know, this margin opportunity, if they reduce the amount that they're selling to you, but they keep it at the same price, that's a phenomenon called shrinkflation. Well, that's kind of a negative outcome for the consumer. But if the consumer wants less of something anyway, because they have a smaller appetite and they want smaller portion sizes, the U.S. is horrible about the size of portions that we offer to people. This is an opportunity for these companies to rebrand and say, no, we're helping you. We're offering you a smaller portion, and that's going along with you on your GLP-1 journey. So I think it's, again, an opportunity for them to use their massive marketing and branding powerhouse capabilities and just reposition how us as consumers think about those products.
Shrinkflation, I think that'd be quite an interesting discussion over the coming months, absolutely, after the State of Union. But it falls straight into those staples companies, right? They can just really use that as another branding message to try and to sort of sell less and bigger margins, I guess, is the critical thing. Obviously that's kind of one reaction. What other potential reactions do you think there are for some of these consumer companies?
I think that they have the opportunity really to focus on, you know, if we're thinking outside of just consumer staples, sort of broadening to the more consumer discretionary landscape as well, it's the opportunity to address the consumer as they're making this change in their lifestyle. So whether it's a company that offers clothing and they have the ability to say, hey, we have a range of sizing that offers anything from a 16X down to a 10X in the exact same style, etc. So I think there's opportunity there to just lean into it as it gains traction on its own. So that can look very different depending on what kind of a company that you're looking at. But I do think that we are early enough in the cycle of this adoption that there are a lot more opportunities in front of us than risks necessarily for these companies.
So you just alluded to that in terms of the consumer losing weight, you know, maybe a different body shape going forward. Mm-hmm. And go to Mike's point, you know, that may just be temporary. You know, how are they going to react to that sort of big shifting in, you know, weight loss, maybe then put half of it back on, I think, as Mike alluded.
Yeah.
How do you think the consumer's going to relate to that?
When you think about how fashion moves over longer cycles, it tends to be based on silhouettes. In the 70s, it was all about the bell bottoms. In the 90s, it was all about the boot cut. In the 2010s, it was all about leggings. And now we're to a straight leg. I mean, there's always this secular element to fashion. But what's interesting here is, will there be enough adoption of the weight loss drugs to where enough people are moving in sizes to where these companies really have to lean into the extended sizing? But then also, when you go back to that demographic information I was telling you that we learned from the Numerator survey, if there are enough higher income users of the drugs, they will be able to spend what they want to spend on their new wardrobe, regardless if they're going from, you know, a 16 to a 12, but they're right now at a 14. Maybe they're going to go out and just buy a handful of, you know, lower price point, but still nice enough items. Or maybe if they think they're going from a 16 to an 8, when they get to that 14, they're just going to go buy a fast fashion option. So it can be anywhere in that spectrum. But I think it's going to really be fleshed out based on where the demographics lie on who is adopting the drug the most. Because we're also seeing in the same Numerator survey that there are plenty of people. It's less of a percentage of the survey, but there are plenty of people in the lower income demographics that are using the drugs as well. And, you know, as Mike was speaking to, with the lower cost alternatives on the private label siding of the drug, there's an opportunity for anyone in any spectrum to be able to lose the weight. So I do think that there is the wardrobe opportunity to where you're saying, you know what, I'm going to look my best. I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy a whole new wardrobe and I'm going to spend a ton of money on it. But the question is, does the consumer wait until they get there, or are they buying in advance of that and are they anticipating it? And if you're a retailer or a brand, you're hoping they're buying in advance of it, because then if they don't get there, they're going to come back and say, I really loved this sweater. I bought it in the wrong size. Like, I'd like to buy another one in my own size, please. So there's an interesting opportunity there for sure.
Again, thinking about this consumer, thinking about fashion, are there any other sort of trends that we really need to be aware of?
Yeah, you know, I hate to look too far into the future, but if there was a situation where, you know, much larger percentages of the U.S. population are using these weight loss drugs, and we have a significant shift in sort of the consumer mentality about their weight, some of the areas where I would highlight that there's an opportunity is that in the travel sector, right? One of the things that inhibits a lot of Americans from traveling is how uncomfortable it is to be on a plane or to be in a bikini when you are at a weight that you aren't happy with. So those consumers, if they are able to get themselves to a lower weight, feel better about themselves, they're going to be more likely to jump on that jet to Aruba and sit at the resort poolside with, you know, a beverage if they want. But there's an opportunity there for those companies to say, you know, we are offering incremental trips, et cetera, if there's more demand and there's more volume for it. And of course, the U.S. is a highly overweight population. And so if you're thinking that that's becoming less, there is incremental demand opportunity there. And then, you know, from a horrible aside for the planes, when the passengers are lighter, the jet fuel is more efficient. So there's an opportunity for the margins there. Another area that I would highlight is, of course, healthier for you activities. And this is something that has, you know, definitely came to the forefront during the pandemic, where whether it was hiking, biking, skiing, just getting outside, all of those activities, that was all we could do during the pandemic. So they got adopted and you know, wide swaths of people really leaned into it. It did tail off, but those were stickier activities and behaviors than I think a lot of people anticipated they would be. If people become more healthy, I think all of those activities become much more available to consumers, especially at the higher end of the spectrum, where if they're losing a significant amount of weight, they have the ability to do something that they physically couldn't do before, whether it's tennis, whether it's pickleball, which is growing like a weed here in the US, golf, whatever it might be. So those are two areas where I would highlight as, you know, sort of a positive beneficiary. On the negative side, though, it's a little bit counterintuitive, but makeup is an area that might do poorly in this same scenario, because as consumers gain more self-esteem and they feel better about themselves, studies show they actually wear less makeup and they are less likely to do all the contouring on their face and wear a ton of product, because they're saying, no, this is me. I don't have to change as much about what I look like. And so that's, you know, all of these are very long-term outcomes, but I was a little surprised at that one, because the other side of that is, well, you're looking better. Wouldn't that mean more makeup? And the reality is the opposite.
Yeah, that's one I would not have picked up, Chelsea, definitely. In terms of a trend, but it certainly makes a lot of sense. I guess Mike and Chelsea, any other things that we're missing around this topic? I think we've really covered literally head to toe and inside.
Yeah. Maybe I'll chime in on activity levels and just echo what Chelsea was saying, is that the big concern is that for the orthopedic sector was, if people lose a lot of weight, perhaps it will be less strain on their hips, less strain on their knees, and so they won't need an artificial version of that. What they found is people are losing weight, they're getting active, and then they're blowing out their knee or they're blowing out their hip. And so you've actually seen an uptick in demand for new knees, new hips, as people are losing weight, which is ironic.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's something is quite an interesting implication.
I'd also just add, just from a really high level perspective, even if these don't become the wonder drug and the be all end all change to obesity, at least it's enough right now that it is starting to move the needle in a way that you can still isolate companies that are either benefiting or being hurt by this trend. And so that's something that Mike and I are working on all the time, is finding companies that are benefiting from this, even if it's only for a year, 2 years, 5 years. I mean, the organic trend has had tons of legs. The cholesterol trend, maybe not as much. So it's finding the companies that are able to adapt and respond to these consumer changes and gain market share. And that's part of what we're doing every day and everything that we're looking at.
No, absolutely. And I think that's quite important. I think, you know, certainly at in terms of the growth strategies that you guys run, but also what we do within our global equity strategies, is we're looking for the mega trends, right? We're looking for the trends that are going to be pervasive for the next 5 or 10 years. And then obviously try and find the best companies that are going to exploit that trend. And, you know, I guess over the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, we're probably going to start finding that nuanced, seeing the companies adapting to that change and be able to say, okay, we think this is an important trend. How do we exploit it to the maximum benefit or shareholders? And I think that's you know, pretty important, why these conversations are so good, and also why these conversations are so important in terms of finding those companies that can exploit that. So both Chelsea and Mike, I want to thank you very much for hopping onto this call. As I said, it's one of our most requested topics, actually, so I'm glad you're able to give it as much justice as you have done. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, thank you. So with that, we'll wrap up the call today. I hope you enjoyed it. And of course, please tune in to Beyond the Benchmark, and we'll have you hopefully listening in again for new and exciting topics. So thank you very much. And we'll wrap up there. Thank you.